the research talks for the SAC members, Rob Myers told me that there was no way that any of them were going to have any steam left to pay attention to this talk, and but I plan to fight back. Let me just begin right from the get-go. So these are, I don't know, if you're not from Canada, you may not know this candy. This is a classic Canadian thing. So if you could just maybe take a couple, pass these around. SAC members are, of course, entitled to a double share. These are Smarties. Well, that could be true. Okay. Okay, so I wanted to give you an overview of cosmology and gravity research at TI over the past few years. What are the highlights from the past few years? So let me start by saying that actually was quite a big area. So by my assessment, it's broke into three major themes. The first has to do with the early universe. So results about what went on in the early universe, what is the Big Bang all about. The second theme was modifying gravity. And I should say, by the way, you know, cosmology and gravity, what it means here, you might say, well, everybody in PI works on gravity, and that is to zeroth order true. But gravity here is used, it's kind of classical gravity, various problems in gravitational waves, astrophysics, black holes that require classical or nearly classical gravity. The second theme has to do with modifying GR, modifying standard gravity on macroscopic scales. So I'll explain when we get there, you know, why and what that's about. And then the third, for lack of a better term, I was not modifying GR, just taking GR to be the correct theory of gravity and seeing what it has to say about various interlocking problems, again, at the interface between gravitational waves, astrophysics, and black hole physics. Before moving on to that, let me just give you an overview of the structure of the group here. I've listed the faculty, the associate faculty, the not group. Sorry, that was the first time I did that. Well, I hope no one keeps count. TRCs and so forth, the people who are new during the period in question, that is in the 2008-2011 period, are bolded, and the people who left during that period are italicized. And I think the first, you know, thing to take away from this is just how much flux there has been in this area.
People in red went to assistant professor.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. So I was first going to say that there's been a lot of flux. In fact, you'll notice that the only person who is not either bold or italicized here is Cliff Burgess. So I actually had to amend the key to give him his own category here. And then the next comment I wanted to make was that of the postdocs who left over this period. Really, they did remarkably well. So the ones in most of them, you see, a very surprisingly high percentage. The ones in red managed to obtain faculty positions, and the ones in green are all currently in postdoc positions. In imitation of Daniel Gottesman's talk, I tried to make a slide that showed the interlap between cosmology and various other areas at PI, and I, this is not a complete list at all. I just added names here until I began to go crazy. And because the fact of the matter is that, you know, everybody, one thing you learn if you're a cosmologist at PI is that everybody, secretly or not, at PI also thinks they're a cosmologist or wants to be a cosmologist. So it's actually great. There's no one at the whole place who doesn't have something interesting to say. So for example, I've only listed, you see the groups that I've listed here. But for example, take quantum foundations. So, you know, perennial thing of interest in early universe cosmology is the so-called wave function of the universe, and Hartle and Hawking had a famous proposal for this. And anyway, so I've been interested in this over the past year, and it turns out the Quantum Foundations people are extremely helpful to talk to about this. But I recommend talking to them before you begin trying to write down your wave function of the universe so you can figure out what it is, even your goal, that you're trying to write down. Take Freddy. I don't know if Freddy's still, yeah, Freddy, you know, you saw his talk this morning. I mean, he has such an armload of, like, spectacular problems, you would think he must be satisfied, right? But no, and this is not speculation. I can tell you as a fact that in his heart he is not satisfied. Even Freddy, formal Freddy, wants to be a cosmologist. Anyway, that's all I'll say about that. So with that intro, let me move on to part one, the early universe. So I have these three themes, you'll recall. Each theme, there's two or three highlights I wanted to briefly explain. So let me start with this recent paper by Matt Johnson and his collaborators, First Observational Tests of Eternal Inflation. This was published recently in PhysRev Letters. It was an editor's suggestion, sort of highlighted by the PRL editors. It's received tons of attention in the science press and the popular press. It nearly melted the internet. What's the idea? The idea is that inflation is this. It's the most popular model of the early universe. It says that the early universe experienced a rapid period of accelerated expansion at early times. And according to the standard current interpretation, most people who believe in inflation think that on scales much larger than our present observable universe, that inflation actually predicts a very inhomogeneous anisotropic universe. So it's sort of like, so I've depicted it here, it's sort of like water with steam bubbles. And so maybe we live in the blue universe and we can't see to the edge of this bubble. To us it looks nearly homogeneous and isotropic. But there are other equally homogeneous and isotropic universes out there. They may have properties even very different from ours. And this picture has led to endless debate among cosmologists and non-cosmologists about whether this is even science. If a person in this universe is completely causally disconnected from all of these other universes, why are we talking about them? What good could this possibly do for scientific discovery in our universe? Everyone had an opinion. Many of them were negative. I just want to say that this paper settles that question. It settles the question of whether this is science, I would say, whether it belongs in a physics department in the following way. That the fact of the matter is that initial picture was not the whole story. These bubbles sometimes collide. Matt was on some of the seminal papers calculating the probability for such collisions to happen along our past light cone, and also on what the observational consequences of them would be. And then, this most recent paper, he just went all the way and did a very thorough analysis, wrote code that would do a blind, sort of statistically unprejudiced search through the most recent CMB data and look for the predicted signal. The details are not crucial here. This is just a sort of nice figure from one of his papers outlining the algorithm according to which the code works. To my mind, this just sort of settles the story, as I said. I mean, it's not fundamentally different from, grand unification predicts proton decay, and we look for it, we haven't detected it yet. But no one complains it's not science, or you look for dark matter, you haven't detected it yet. I just think this makes it clear that this is in that category. And they found four candidates, four intriguing candidates, not at the level where they claim a detection of a collision with another universe yet. Planck data will be coming out very soon, and it will provide a much more stringent search. And I would just say, let's all look forward to the next to the SAC meeting 3 years from now when we can congratulate him on his Nobel Prize. Okay, next highlight. This is one of my papers with Paul Steinhardt. It was also a PRL. This one was highlighted by a Viewpoint article, and there's this APS Journal of Physics that they try to highlight. The editors try to highlight papers that they think are significant. So they sent me this letter when they decided to put it in the Journal of Physics, and it's saying that, you know, only 150 articles each year were selected out of 20,000 papers published in PhysRev. And of course, the shocking thing there is just that 20,000 papers are published every year in PhysRev. It should make us all, I mean, these astronomical numbers. Okay, so I thought maybe I could just, you know, is it, I would love to, my mouth is getting very dry, actually. Is there water nearby? I apologize about this. I just don't want, well, thanks. Thanks, Luis. Sorry about that. So the idea is simple to explain, the basic idea, and it is this, that, so, you know, you can kind of get the impression from talking to cosmologists these days that we know that inflation took place in the early universe, that it's more or less a done deal, and that the goal of future cosmological observations is to determine which model of inflation is right, which fundamental physics model is correct. And, you know, the idea of this paper was to take the view that that the question of whether inflation actually happened is still a vital one. And the question is what, you know, a problem is that inflation, a lot of the successes of inflation have this kind of generic character. It predicts that the primordial perturbation spectrums were nearly a power law, nearly scale invariant, nearly Gaussian. A lot of these things have a, you know, there's no prediction of the sort, you know, such and such, no prediction that has been confirmed so far of the sort, such and such has to be 0.89324. The sort of thing that, for example, convinced everyone, you know, G minus 2 of the electron, that convinced everyone QED had to be on the right track. So what could you do with forthcoming observations that would give you qualitatively more confidence that inflation was actually right? Well, so consider the following point. So if we think about the density perturbation today, whose wavelength is the same as the Hubble radius of the universe, the observable radius of the universe today. Well, the Hubble radius evolves with time, and so does the wavelength of that perturbation. But according to inflation, they're not only equal today, those two lengths, but as you follow them back in time, there was also some point deep during the inflationary era where they were also equal. Okay, so that earlier point is depicted here. And then in co-moving coordinates, the wavelength of the density perturbation is constant from then until today. But the size of the Hubble radius shrinks by a stupendous factor and then grows by a stupendous factor. And, you know, you can see from the diagram that for the whole thing to make sense, the factor by which it shrunk between that moment and the end of inflation has to be precisely equal to the factor by which it grew between the end of inflation and today for things to make sense. And the simple point is just that forthcoming cosmological observations give you natural estimates of these two, of the shrinking factor and the growing factor. And if those two things turn out to be equal, it will be such spectacularly specific evidence for the correctness of inflation that even the most hardened skeptic will say that it is correct. The two figures on the right, maybe I won't dwell on them. They should. What? What if they don't?
No. If R is 0.1 and NS is 0.96, that the most hardened skeptic will accept inflation.
Sure. I'll bet on that.
There are well-known counterexamples in the history of physics.
it's a good prediction.
I'll bet on Paul, if that's what you mean. I think
you're betting on the outcome, or you're betting on the response to the outcome?
Response to the outcome.
Do you want to bet on the outcome?
Okay. Well, let's leave this until after the... the main point here that I wanted to make with these figures is that the relations between forthcoming observables that would have to hold in order for these two estimates to be equal to one another will be confirmed or ruled out by realistic, and in some cases, near-term cosmological experiments. So, but the test would be just as convincing as confirming the celebrated consistency relations of inflation. But in contrast to those consistency relations, these will be confirmed or ruled out. The consistency relations can't be confirmed by realistic experiments. One of the things you have to measure, you'll just never be able to measure to the required accuracy.
You're not telling us how you measure these two.
CMD experiments, other cosmological experiments. This is R, the tensor to scalar ratio, and NS. These are two of the fitting parameters used by WMIP for the CMB data. So is alpha S is the running of the spectral index. It's another parameter that sometimes they include in their bits.
So one of the things that seems obvious to you, but was not very obvious to me, is that if you have an extremely large number of e-folds during inflation, that this earlier crossing time is determined entirely by R, not the value of R.
This is not the beginning of inflation.
I know.
Yeah.
But is what I just said a correct statement?
So the things that WMAP measures are all, in single field inflation, they are measuring the properties of the potential, not some global properties. They're measuring the properties of the potential at the moment, at this moment in time.
Measuring things up there, right?
I guess what I mean to say is that the signal that's imprinted in the CMB, you can think of it as being imprinted, the signal that is being observed in the CMB on the largest scales was imprinted at this moment, more or less.
So if I just make the simple hypothesis for what happened before.
I think the whole argument is completely insensitive to what happened earlier than earlier.
Yeah, that's right. And it's just determined. So there's a simple model where it's just determined by the single parameter, little r. And maybe you could just say a few words to that.
What is the idea? So the point is just this: that in single field inflation, what you're measuring when you measure when you fit to the primordial power spectrum of CMB scales. You are doing, that's directly corresponds to estimating making your best estimate for the function V of phi, or it turns out to be better to think about H, the Hubble constant, as a function of phi. And you would love to just get the exact function, but that's more than you can ask for. You can't observe the whole function. The best you get is you get the Taylor expansion, H of phi. So if you take that as your best estimate for H of phi, the idea is just,
Oh, I see. So V of phi is constant in the period below that line, TE.
No, but your best estimate for how it's changing,
but the simplest model is it's just constant. It's entirely determined by the value of R.
It can't be.
The point is that a derivative actually.
If it was really just strictly constant, then inflation would never end.
Yes.
So you can't. It'll be clear why that. The idea here is that you get your best estimate that the observations will afford of H as a function of phi, and then from that best estimate, you can make your best estimate of two things: how much expansion happens until the end of inflation.
Yes.
But for that, you need a function with which inflation ends. You need to be able to look down your best estimate and say, when does inflation end? And well, so that's the key point. That's why a constant, you can't really think about a constant. Things are still.
Well, I'm not really happy, but what am I just saying?
Okay.
R is 16 epsilon, so it tells you how fast actually H is, or potential is changing.
That's true.
So the larger the R is, in some sense, the faster the potential is changing, so the quicker inflation would end.
Yeah, in practice, R does tell you the height of the potential. Mm-hmm. It tells you, and it also tells you the slope of the potential.
Oh, I see.
Right, the logarithmic slope of the potential.
Oh, and then, I
together with the R in combination with the amplitude.
That's true with a model where you take the minimal number of Fourier components, then you can add more.
Yeah, I mean, you take as many as you can given the observations you have. And then the third paper is this paper, Quantum Resolution of Cosmological Singularities with ADS CFT. Or, well, maybe that was my title for the overall research program. I think the paper in question that I wanted to highlight was this one with a more technical name. Okay, so what's the idea here? In the 70s, Hawking taught us that that according to classical and semi-classical expectations, when a black hole collapses, the information that falls into the black hole is stuck there. It never reemerges. And when the black hole ultimately evaporates and goes away, the information is destroyed. And then ADS CFT came along in the 90s, and one of the most significant impacts that it has had is to convince many physicists that picture isn't right. That when you go beyond the semi-classical picture, that in fact somehow the information is preserved during black hole evaporation, because the process of black hole collapse and evaporation in the bulk is, according to ADS-CFT, exactly dual to some manifestly unitary thing going on the boundary. So, at a glance, the Big Bang and Big Crunch singularities have a lot in common with that. You're naturally led to wonder. I mean, according to semi-classical expectations, when you go to a Big Crunch, the information just hits the Big Crunch, and then time ends and it disappears. But you might hope that that the semi-classical expectation is just wrong there, just as it was for black holes, and that maybe ADS-CFT can do it again. Maybe it can come to the rescue again. So, I think it's clear that, when I say that intro to myself, it sounds extremely important. I mean, it sounds like if you have a that's a question that you really want to know the answer to. Does ADS-CFT applied to a crunching space-time tell you that, in fact, the information does not end at the singularity, but continues somehow unitarily through? You'd like to know the answer. So I should have said, I meant to not just start using the word ADS-CFT, which, because after all, if I were in the audience, I would want someone to explain ADS-CFT to me before talking about it. So I should at least do the same service to you guys. So according to my cartoon understanding of what ADS-CFT is, you have ADS space-time. When you conformally compactify it, it looks like a cylinder. And the idea is that according to the more general gauge gravity correspondence, full quantum gravity in the inside of the cylinder, as described by some variation of string theory, is completely equivalent to some appropriate non-gravitational field theory, quantum field theory living on the boundary. So the original version of ADS-CFT related a five-dimensional ADS space-time to a four-dimensional boundary. A recent development of, I think, just a few years ago was that for four-dimensional ADS, a conjecture was put forward, so-called ABJM theory. That's the conjectured correct theory on the boundary that's dual. And so what Neil and his collaborators, Ben Krafts and Thomas Hertog, have done is show that, if you modify the boundary conditions that determine sort of what modes are present in the bulk, if instead of taking normal supersymmetric boundary conditions, you take some non-supersymmetric boundary conditions, you get a bulk space-time which instead of being stable, collapses to a space-like singularity that cuts across the whole space-time. And then it corresponds to a certain deformation on the boundary of this ABJM theory. They explicitly find what the deformation is. So then they have some field theory they can study on the boundary, and they analyze its UV fixed points, and That's what this paper is about, analyzing basically the UV fixed points of that theory and arguing that somehow the physics near that UV fixed point is, if I understand correctly, sort of dual to the physics that's going on in the bulk sort of near the Big Crunch singularity. That's as far as this paper goes. I know that this is work in progress, and I know that there's a paper of Neil's that is gestating that has been gestating, and sounds very exciting. I think one of the ideas that I've taken away from hearing talks about that is that one idea is that you can sort of smoothly match the boundary onto you can take the crunch of one such space time and the Big Bang of another such space time, and it's perfectly smooth to match the boundaries, and the conformal symmetry on either side of the boundary somehow completely determines how the field theories match into a single hole, and that maybe is the appropriate way to see how things must go through in the bulk. Is that roughly correct? Anyway, I think that sounds exciting. Okay, part two, modifying gravity. Do you need more? Did those previous ones make it around? Okay. Oh, well. Okay. Part two, modifying gravity. So the motivation here is easy to describe. One of the things we learned from WMAP and other cosmological observations and that we've been stuck with for about 10 years now is this absurd picture of the universe in which about 5% is the stuff in the periodic table, and then another quarter is something called dark matter, and that we don't really know what it is, and another 3/4 is something called dark energy, and we don't really know what it is. And, you know, it can't help but give you pause that these two mysterious components that dominate the universe, that the only, you know, convincing evidence for them at the moment comes from their gravitational interactions. It can't help but make you think, well, maybe that is a clue that, you know, maybe it is true that there are these other energy components out there. But another possibility that you can't help thinking about is the possibility that maybe, you know, we don't understand gravity on astrophysical and cosmological scales as well as we think we do. And so, you know, arguably the biggest single contribution of the sort of work in this area at PI over the past several years has been sort of the many-fingered exploration of this possibility. It's really, I think PI, as far as I'm aware, is unique in terms of just the number of different modifications that have been proposed, explored for their theoretical consistency, explored for their observational, whether they're still alive observationally. And so I just wanted to very briefly go through three examples. Actually, I'm going to very lightly touch over in maybe just a sentence or two the first two examples here. And then spend a little bit more time on the third example, just to give you a flavor of what I'm talking about. Okay, so this first set of papers about the idea of cascading gravity. Well, so the modification of general relativity that attracted the most theoretical and observational attention over the past decade is the so-called DGP model, which in short is some model of gravity where we live on a four-dimensional brain, but the real universe is five-dimensional. But for a long time, people tried and failed to write down extensions of that model to higher dimensions. They were always plagued by pathologies and ambiguities of one sort or another. And that was cleverly solved. That problem of generalizing it to higher dimensions was cleverly solved in these papers and then shown to be sensible. So the basic idea, which was kind of clever, was to put take our brain and embed it in a brain of one dimension higher, and then embed that brain in one of one dimension higher, and so on. And if you just continue cascading in this manner, life is groovy. You don't have anyway. You solve the problems of those previous attempts. A second idea that received a lot of attention over the past decade was this idea, the so-called Tevez theory. So here, it had been proposed in the early 80s that you could modify Newton's law slightly at low accelerations, and in that way explain the rotation curves of galaxies without having to invoke dark matter. But there was a long-standing problem of how to write down a relativistic generalization of that theory. That was at the level of Newton's laws. So finally, a few years ago, five or six years ago, Jacob Bekenstein finally wrote down, did succeed in writing down a relativistic generalization of it. And the question was then, well, is this actually a viable theory? In particular, is it consistent with all the stuff we now know about cosmology that we didn't know, say, in the early 80s? And a PI postdoc who has left, Constantino Skordis, basically took it upon himself to individually, he sort of realized that there was actually some huge task of rederiving much of observational cosmology within this framework if he wanted to check whether it was correct or not. So he sort of took this on, did a mammoth amount of work over multiple years, and became the sort of world's expert on it. And I'm just quoting a recent invited review that he wrote about it. And finally, a third example is the gravitational ether theory, and I just wanted to focus a little bit more on this. So this is a great example. You know, you've heard it, as you know, a lot of research at PI sort of starts from maybe basic principles, axioms. This is a nice example of a sort of approach to getting information about nature coming from the other direction. It's very, very simple-minded and bottom-up, and it's really a beautiful example of this approach. So what is the idea? So Einstein's equations are T mu nu. The Einstein tensor is equal to T mu nu, the stress energy tensor. Quantum field theory appears to tell us that T mu nu should have some gargantuan contribution from the vacuum energy, that the cosmological constant should, by the estimates of quantum field theorists, be stupendously larger than what we observe. But the vacuum energy is really the trace part of T mu nu. So the simplest thing you might think of doing is just say, well, maybe Einstein's equations is just G mu nu is equal to the traceless part of T mu nu. Just subtract off the trace. Well, that is not consistent, because by the Bianchi identities, the divergence of the left side vanishes. So the divergence of the right side had better vanish. And so the simplest thing you can add to the right-hand side to reintroduce, to correct the Bianchi identities, but not reintroduce a trace, is a term like this, a term that's automatically traceless times some coefficient that has to be determined by the constraint equations in order to get the Bianchi identities right. And so that's it. The idea is that simple to explain, but now you can just ask, is this theory consistent with the data or not? You can test it in many different ways. Niaj has written a series of papers showing different observational consequences of this and assessing whether any of them managed to rule out the theory. And so, in particular, a recent paper of this sort, he and his student Farbad Kamiab showed that if you calculate the radius between the mass and radius, if you calculate the relation between the mass and radius of a neutron star, do you guys need more Smarties? Am I killing you here? What's the general attitude here? Am I talking to blank? Okay, yes, sorry. So, to make a long story short, you can calculate the mass and radius relation for ordinary GR, for Niaj's theory. The ordinary GR curves are these darker ones. Niaj's are the lighter ones. So in particular, they predict a maximum mass for the neutron star like this. There are the two most massive observed neutron star masses are up here. So at least for these two equations of state, which are sort of standard equations of state used to model neutron stars, Niaj has managed to rule out his own theory. Which I have to say, I mean, the first thing I should say is that we really don't know the equation of state of a neutron star. So there are other equations of state which are consistent with these observations for Niaj's theory. But the other thing is that, you know, how many among you have actually made a sincere, concerted effort to rule out your own theory? I think he's an honored group, rare and honored group. I also just want to highlight Niaj as a sort of homegrown PI success story. He was first a postdoc here, and then he became an associate faculty with Waterloo, and over the past year has been winning awards left and right, including an NSERC, a special accelerator grant from NSERC, an Ontario Ministry of Research and Innovation Earlier Research Award, and the Professor M.P. Vainubapu Gold Medal of the Indian Astronomical Society. Okay, part three. Sorry that part two was ran over. Okay, not modifying gravity. Well, so I'm actually on time, but the question is, am I killing the SAC? Are you guys holding up okay? Okay. So if I spend 15 minutes on part three, that will be. Okay. Great. Yeah. Sure. Yes. Although that's the one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go for it.
Okay, so there's this interesting business with the CMB, extremely well known, that the P-kites tell you that
variant of dark matter ratio.
Tell you the variant of dark matter ratio, or more specifically, that there was a two-component plasma at the time of these acoustic oscillations. So now there seems to be a big deviation in the third peak, which I have no idea. Because I haven't studied this paper, how robust that is.
Yeah.
Is there a simple physical explanation for that? And is it actually robust, or can you tile the parameters so that that effect goes away?
This I don't know the answer to. I wish Constantinos was here.
And if you do a baryons only universe, it makes a huge difference in the third peak, right? And right. So in Tevis. And, I was inspired to go back and see what Skordis finally published. Skordis was saying for a long time, and Ferrara, that with they had enough free parameters, basically, in Tevis, that they could have the scalar field reproduce what the dark matter was doing and fit the CMB field. But I have not seen, and to be fair, I may have missed one of their most recent papers, a paper where they actually show here's where we stand with here's the fit to all the data we have today.
Yeah, I'm not sure at all that the current situation is that they claim that it's it's possible that they I'm actually not sure current viability is.
What is this fit?
Oh, these are just, I think they're showing for some, I believe this is an earlier generation of CMB data probably.
Right, so with the 2003 WMAP data, the first year data, the third peak wasn't very well measured.
Right.
And they could fit that.
Yes.
And since then, we've measured it much better, and the small scale experiments, the stuff we've done on the ground, we've measured to the seventh peak quite accurately.
Yes.
And, I've not seen them publish anything showing they can fit it, but,
Okay. That may very well be. I mean, the thing I want to stress is not that he. I don't think that this highlight rests on whether it's right or not. I think that the fact that we know whether it's if we
I'm
know whether
curious.
It's right or no. Yeah, I'm just saying. No.
Skordis did. It was a lot of work to do this calculation for Tevis, and yeah. Skordis did it, and it's a real service. Unfortunately, I think he's left the field.
No,
where is he?
He's in the UK. I
think. Okay.
Nottingham,
that's right.
Because I would love to see a more
he's working on other modified GR.
Okay.
Modifications of GR, but
just to clarify, when you say there's a problem with the third peak, you mean there's a problem for Tevis, is there
yes.
a statement?
Yes. And statement, Lambda CDM for better or for worse fits everything incredibly well. but what needs to be quantified better is how much does this constrain alternative gravity theories?
Yeah.
Right. There aren't good theories that fit that don't have dark matter that fit this. But there's not a generic proof of that. That must be dark matter. It can't be modified gravity.
Thank you. Okay. I'm sorry.
No problem. You can see that you can see from these plots what he can't do. For example, for the matter power spectrum, it doesn't look like he can exactly reproduce. For example. Lambda CDM curve. So it's a matter of, I don't think that he can perfectly mimic Lambda CDM. I think it's a question of which one is favored by the data. And it may well be that it's highly disfavored. Okay, sorry. not modifying here. Okay, so yeah, so here I wanted to start before giving you the two highlights. I wanted to just start by giving you an impression of how this area has really grown a lot just over the past year at PI. And so one way to say it is to look at the spectrum of possible gravitational wave detectors, sort of different ways which people are trying to detect gravitational waves. So maybe I'll start by saying, why are people trying to detect gravitational waves? You know, sort of one of the big lessons of astronomy in the 20th century was that when you have a new window onto the universe, you should look through it, because you'll see crazy stuff you didn't expect. So the best example of this is radio astronomy, where already in the late 1800s, people realized they could build radio telescopes, but everyone thought they knew what was out there. There was going to be nothing interesting to see, so they didn't build them for like 50 years. And then when they finally built them, they saw all of the most spectacular and interesting stuff in astrophysics today, including pulsars, quasars, you know, supermassive black holes, sending giant radio jets out of galaxies, and most spectacularly, the cosmic microwave background radiation. So, with gravitational waves, we know there's crazy interesting stuff out there to see, because the best sources we know of for gravitational waves are two black holes orbiting around each other and merging. But also, I would say that one of the key motivations is just that second one, that we don't know. So I wanted to just briefly give you a scope, a sense of this is a way to see how suddenly that there's kind of expertise spanning the different approaches to gravitational wave astronomy at PI. So you won't be surprised that to know that so primordial gravitational waves can leave an imprint in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. And this is something that I worked on a lot in the past, but also this is something where a lot of people. It's not new to PI. A lot of people, you won't be surprised that early universe cosmologists have been doing stuff related to this already at PI. The new things are really these subsequent ones. So here, I was working over the past year on gravitational wave detection with pulsar timing arrays with my colleague Willie Penn at CETA. The one sentence summary of our results maybe is that, so the idea of a pulsar timing array is you have these. Nature has been kind enough to sprinkle ultra-stable clocks through the galaxy. There are these pulsars in the shape of lighthouses emitting very stable beam, ticking radiation. And by timing that very accurately, you can be sensitive to a distant gravitational wave from some other galaxy that comes passing through our own galaxy. Here we're talking about gravitational waves with quite low frequencies. So they oscillate once per year, once per 10 years, something like that. And what we showed in brief is that the traditional view that this will be, that these detectors will be confused, that they will see so many sources per frequency bin that the sources will all mush together into an effectively stochastic background, that view is likely to be wrong. And you will make an error in thinking about and analyzing the data as if it were true. You should think of them really as resolving point source telescopes, and that furthermore, the angular resolution they will have is in some cases parametrically better than people had realized. Louis Lehner is doing world-leading numerical simulations of the sources, numerical relativity simulations of the sources for these two experiments, LISA, or whatever comes out, whatever replaces LISA, and the ground-based detector LIGO. I'll say more about him in a second.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
What's the data situation for pulsar? Are there public data repositories clocked to a given standard that you can just analyze?
I think the pulsar timing data is, yes, I think it is. To be honest, what we didn't do, I was not analyzing pulsar timing data. So that is like a very deep, if you want to, is there stuff where the systematics and ephemeris have been fit out so you have actual data that a non-expert could deal with, like me or something? I mean, I actually don't know. I don't know if that's true. I think there is some, because there was actually a claim. There was a guy, I think, in Russia who claimed to use publicly available data this past year to detect gravitational waves using pulsar timing, which I think most people think is not right. But anyway, it's actually not that far. It's actually you may not know this, but it's not at all unrealistic that this could, you know, 10 years from now have detected gravitational waves, depending on if we're lucky to have a source nearby.
When we did the decadal survey, we our thought was this was, and a lot of people in the field think that the pulsar timing arrays will see it first.
Yeah, I could see it first before LIGO. I mean, it's very different sources. Every one of these things is looking at very different sources. So it's not like it's whoever gets there first wins. I mean, they're looking completely different.
Are there collaborations?
Huge international collaborations.
Yeah, but it's interesting. It's people, it was very, you know, for suddenly within the past few years, everyone has realized, like, wow, it's sort of like a very dark horse thing. Everyone was like, wow, we didn't realize how close they were to detecting gravitational waves or how good it would be, or anyway. Okay, let's see. I won't discuss this again. You may remember from the previous SAC meeting, I told you guys about the work that I had done recently about the possibility of doing ground-based gravitational wave detection at frequencies significantly below LIGO, but still on the Earth, and the sort of design principles and optimal telescope designs for gravitational wave detection in that regime. I want to highlight here at the highest frequency, in the highest frequency band, LIGO, that we have a senior postdoc here, Chad Hanna, who is a member of the LIGO collaboration. He, since coming here, has successfully petitioned LIGO for, he and his collaborator, Kip Cannon, who's in CETA, has successfully petitioned for LIGO and CETA to be joint members of LIGO. So this is the first Canadian membership in LIGO. And so that means, you know, if you're a Canadian grad student and you want to work on LIGO, you should come to PI. It's really quite a big deal. It's kind of like having an LHC membership or something like that. First thing he did while at PI was finish the search for massive black hole in spiral in LIGO 1. So that's one of the two key sources that LIGO and Advanced LIGO are looking for. And the significant thing I want to mention here is that this is the first search that actually incorporated and had to incorporate the very recent results from numerical relativity. Numerical relativity, you may know, only recently succeeded in getting their codes to merge black holes and predict the waveforms from the final stages of merger, from that most interesting stage. And so anyway, it was a very novel task to weave that into the whole LIGO pipeline. Maybe more importantly now, he's leading the effort to prepare for Advanced LIGO. Advanced LIGO is now only a year or so away at the beginning of data collection.
Right. 2016,
it's coming. You say it's turning on.
So
a year or so until they begin
testing. Single arm tests quite soon.
Yeah.
And then perhaps school and conference talk soon. There probably won't be science data until 2019,
2015. Okay, anyway. So the point here is that you know, the data analysis to determine whether there were gravitational wave signals in the data in initial LIGO took, you know, years. The analysis might come out, you know, a year and a half, 2 years after the data was collected. But there's huge science advantage if you can detect the gravitational waves in real time and send out alerts to astronomical telescopes to say, you know, there's an event going on right now. There's an event that just happened where two black holes merged. But to do that, you know, these things happen fast. You need to be able to detect the signal in, I don't know, let's say a minute or something. So anyway, so he's leading this effort with Kip Cannon to devise tricks and implement them in the LIGO data pipeline to speed up the process from you know, decrease the latency from years to minutes. And anyway, I just wanted to, you all learned that from the names from the giant list of names on the author list. So that's a very important thing I wanted to know. So next two are from Luis. Who happened to have two very spectacular results in the past year or so. So the first one is related to what we were just talking about. So there's enormous science to be gained by if when you detect a gravitational wave signal, you can also see the electromagnetic signal from that source. But to do that, you know, what electromagnetic signal? No one really knows yet what the electromagnetic signal is that you should be looking for, but you probably need to know to be able to look for it and detect it efficiently. So they don't know because probably the most interesting signals will be produced in this highly dynamical space-time geometry near the merger where no one really has any good intuition for what the electromagnetic fields and the plasma are doing there. Okay, so this is really where Luis and his group are making world-leading contributions, and so they had this very, you know, they had this very pioneering paper this past, well, it was in Science in 2010, which with this very memorable picture of what goes on there, which is kind of easy to remember after you see it, but would have been very hard to, well, was not predicted before the simulations came along. And so that is the following, that as the two black holes in spiral, and they're embedded here in some magnetic field and matter, as they in spiral, contrary to what you expect, usually you think of a spinning black hole as generating a jet of radiation. But here we have two non-spinning black holes individually are non-spinning, but as they get close to one another, their rotational motion by itself generates, each black hole begins to separately generate a jet, a highly collimated beam of radiation, well before merger, when they're still well separated. And then as they get closer, the two jets kind of weave together as a double-stranded rope or something like that. And then as the black holes merge and ring down to a single one, the jet also sort of, they show in their simulations, sort of rings down to a standard Blanford-Snyak jet for a single black hole. So anyway, that's maybe the picture that you should remember in your mind. They make a number of other predictions about the final signal, but that's really a very important thing. I mean, somehow to be able to have some basic picture of what is even going on in that regime is a very important step. The second result is equally cool. Maybe let me stop. Well, I blew my punchline. I almost blew my punchline here. What I meant to say is that so in the early 90s, Gregory and Laflamme discovered one of the most important distinctions between black holes' general relativity in four dimensions and general relativity in higher dimensions. When they discovered that, I should say as an aside, you probably know this, but the Laflamme is Ray Laflamme, who is currently the director of the IQC and an associate in quantum information here, and Ruth Gregory also has come and taught at PSI the past 2 years. In any case, so what they showed, they realized that they found a five-dimensional stationary black hole, which is just the five-dimensional black string. It's basically a black hole that has an extended spatial direction along the line. Its singularity is line-like. That if you perturb it a little bit, that there are perturbation modes that you can see in linear order already grow. So unlike black holes in four dimensions, which are stable, that's a key thing about GR in four dimensions. Black holes are stable. Black holes in five dimensions are not stable. But then what is the endpoint of that instability? Where is it going to go? One possibility is that the endpoint is that it will that the initially translationally invariant black hole will reach some non-translationally invariant equilibrium state. That's one possibility. That's one possibility which seems ugly, but before you declare it too ugly, compare it to the other possibility, which is that the horizon pinches off and you form separate black holes here. Because it's a classic result of GR that for the horizon to pinch off like that, you would have to form a naked singularity, a singularity in the space-time curvature that was not cloaked behind the horizon. So that's a second fundamental thing about GR in four dimensions, is that it's widely believed that the so-called principle of cosmic censorship is widely believed to hold, that in generic collapses, that is in all but a set of measure zero initial data, a collapse leads to a singularity that's cloaked behind the horizon, so that to an outside observer like you and me, you don't need to know quantum gravity, you don't need to know what's going on at the singularity to make predictions about your everyday life. You only need to know about quantum gravity if you dive into the, or not, well, you only need to know what goes on at the singularity, I mean to say, if you dive into the black hole. As long as you stay outside, you don't. Okay, so the question is, which actually happens in the black string? Well, it can't be settled analytically, and so Luis and Franz Pretorius, a DRC here, did these simulations recently that settled the issue. So here's what happens. First of all, the picture of what actually happens is very beautiful. It's, what you get is a sort of self-similar cascade, where first you get big black holes connected by a small string, but then that goes unstable, and you get littler black holes connected by an even thinner string, and then even littler black holes connected by even thinner strings. But the point is that what they show is that each stage of that cascade happens four times as fast, and so that there's basically a geometric series that converges. They give very good evidence, although it gets harder and harder to follow successive generations of the instability numerically. They provide very convincing evidence that in fact that the radius does completely pinch off at a finite time, even as observed, even according to an outside asymptotic observer like you and me. So in other words, they show that unlike in four dimensions, in higher dimensions, generic initial data give rise to cosmic violations of cosmic censorship, give rise to naked singularities. So you can imagine that this may well be a very important part of interpreting what the universe is like if it really involves more than four dimensions. Okay, and then finally, I just wanted to end with a brief case of our new faculty member.
I thought many years ago, Preston Jankowski had some numerical evidence for four-dimensional objects that cosmic censorship was violated.
So the only examples of cosmic censorship violation in four dimensions, I think the first example came in the 90s after following on the work of Choptaw Committee. Well, you know, basically, I think the first example of 4D violation was the Choptaw business, right?
That's right. But then,
but those are there. You have to tune. It's a set of measures here. You have to very specially tuned initial conditions. Just get you a very mild.
But he's right. So Shapiro Tarkovsky did claim to have a naked spin singularity, but the evidence is very, very inconclusive, and that work hasn't been followed up. So
I see.
The jury's still out.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so I was going to say here, this is my last thing, by the way. I have more Smarties, but it may be too late. you probably have all seen this movie. Well, maybe you have seen this movie. It's an actual movie taken over 15 years of images from 95 until the present of stars moving around the black hole at the center of our galaxy. From the motions of these stars, you can conclude that there is a object that you can't see. It's emitting. It's dark. It weighs several million times the mass of our sun, but it's confined to a very tiny region, which is I think the closest approach of one of those stars is only something like 17 light minutes from the black hole, which is to be compared with the Earth's sun distance, which is eight light minutes, or maybe it's 17 hours. Anyway, it's a very small region. It's very good evidence that there's a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. And you might ask, can you see? You know, are there any astronomical observations that could actually produce a resolved image of that black hole? And the answer is yes. So the answer is, first of all, this black hole turns out to be, it is believed to be the single astronomical object in the universe that, to an astronomer on the Earth, its horizon subtends the largest spot on the sky. It's the biggest black hole in the sky for us, for astronomers on Earth. So it's really our best opportunity to produce a resolved image of a black hole. So can you do it? The answer is yes, you can do it. To do it, you have to do radio observations at about a millimeter and interfere different radio observations between different telescopes that are separated by of order the radius of the Earth. So put different radio telescopes, each set up with millimeter wave detectors, on as far apart as possible on the Earth, take that data, and you will be able to, the resolution, the diffraction limit that you find comparing that wavelength to that baseline separation between the radio telescopes is smaller than the event horizon of the black hole at the center of our galaxy. So Avery is the main theorist working on this project. These observations are being done now. They have already, I'll show you in a minute what Avery says is the current picture that we've taken of the black hole at our galactic center. But you know, just for fun, I mean, you know, the idea is to go from a picture like this two, you know, here, this is just sort of not astrophysically realistic, it's just for fun illustration, a movie made by Avery of a hotspot moving around the interstable circular orbit, sort of the inner edge of the accretion disk, around the black hole center of our galaxy, and, you know, how it would look to an observer looking at it from different, as you rotate the equatorial planes at different angles.
But that's a totally toy model.
That's a totally toy model, exactly.
No physics.
Right. So, but here, I wish Avery was here. Avery couldn't be here, but this, so this image from the cover of Science News is what he would argue is our current picture of the black hole at the galactic center. So what he means by this is something like, so really, we have not yet taken this photograph of the black hole at the galactic center. Although, someday we will take this photograph. Someday, not too far away, we will take this photograph. But at the moment, it's more like when you know what your eyes do, you take, they sample from your field of view, and after they make enough samples, they combine that with what they know about reality to produce your perception of a continuous picture of reality. So they're doing something like that here. That basically what they're showing is that with the most realistic model of the accretion flow around the black hole that they can produce, and the most realistic radiative transfer and propagation to us that they can handle, they can produce models that has some number of free parameters, and they can twiddle the free parameters until they obtain the best fit for the data. And so this is their best fit, but then they can also show that best fit is, you know, dramatically better than, you know, if you just, just a random blob of radiation or a Gaussian blob of radiation or various unmodeled sources. So there's quite good evidence that they're seeing something like this, but, you know, the situation is that we're viewing it with quite blurry glasses at the moment, but the observations are improving very rapidly, just on a year-to-year basis, and, you know, so the glasses will get sharper and sharper year after year, and yeah, it's just, well, I mean, it's going to be humanity's first glimpse of the first picture of a black hole. I mean, it's an amazing thing. So that's the recap. Well, maybe I just wanted to end by just saying one thing to connect the final two themes. So the gravitational wave observations and Avery's radio observations, you know, are going to really give us our first good tests of general relativity in a regime where we've never tested it. All of our tests of general relativity are in the weak field regime so far, and we've never, all of its wildest predictions are in the regime where the curvature is strong, where the curvature radius is comparable to the system under study, and that's never the regime that we tested in. And so, yeah, it's going to be a big deal. It's going to be a big test for general relativity, and also a boon for astrophysics when we finally do. And of course, it will link up very closely with this earlier theme, because, you know, if gravity is really modified on macroscopic scales, one good place to look for that is in cosmological observations. But of course, another good place to look for it is in these regions of strong curvature, where deviations from general relativity might be expected to get larger. So, maybe I'll end there.
So, I know this is Avery's work, but the paper they published doesn't claim to see a black hole. It says a factor 4 improvement in sensitivity, we'll see it. That's what they have in FJ.
That's what, who has
it? That's Broderick, there's Doman and Loeb, 2011. I mean, maybe there's something that's come out since.
I mean, they have been claiming for several years to be able to
no, no, to resolve, be able to do it.
No, they've been claiming to resolve structure so they've been claiming to resolve it depends what you mean by detect a black hole. So they've been imaging fluctuations comparable to the
power
to the horizon
on the
steps.
Scale of the horizon size.
Power on scale of the horizon size.
In the fluctuations. It's.
Yeah.
I mean, to present it as that image is a.
It would be good if Avery was here. I'm not prepared to go to battle
yeah.
with you about this, but I know Avery would.
but actually, to be fair, I think that image, I think you measure three modes of that image. I think that's the state. So you don't measure every pixel. There are three Fourier modes, and I think
right.
if you measure I don't know, probably 300, you can invest for the transform and make the image. But right now, you
yeah, well, so the first thing to say, that's right. That's right. I mean,
yeah.
What they're doing right now is saying that if you take, I agree, they don't have enough points in the Fourier plan to invert and get a reasonable image.
Right.
But what he does claim is that they have enough points in the Fourier plan to heavily favor that model over let's say a Gaussian blob or
a there's power. You only have 3 points in the Fourier domain. They've got both plugins.
Now I don't think that's right either. I think once upon a time they had 3 points.
It's very good work.
I think you're
presenting it in a way that's an overinterpretation of what they've got.
I believe that they have, first of all, more points in the Fourier plane than they have free parameters in the model. That's one thing. I think they have significantly more points in the Fourier plane than they have.
So I think that's good. I agree with that, they have a model and then they fit for the parameters of model based on the data, and
right.
There is a preferred fit. They can put constraints on the spin and the mass and stuff like that. So yeah, you can do that. You don't have to have a full image to be able to do that, even if you have six or a handful of points. Yeah.
But one thing I do agree is that for me to present it so confidently without actually having significant knowledge of it is, I didn't want to disappoint it. I didn't want to tell Avery that I undersold it, but you're right. It's kind of ridiculous for me to do it.
Oh,
but
the mass is known. Can you recover the mass accurately from the imaging?
Not unless you know the distance, I don't think.
We know the distance.
We know the distance.
But to what? But to, well.
To the galactic center? Well, we know back to the orbits of that galactic center.
You get the same mass from the image. That's a question it seems one can answer.
Yeah. Actually, it would be interesting to get, in principle, you know, you'd be able to measure the spin.
Yes.
Right? Because, you know, is this, you think black holes from other observations are often quite rapidly rotating, you know, with A over M is 0.9. And that's probably reasonable too.
So he claims to have the first measurement of the spin as he says it's 0.3 plus or minus 0.3.
I'd be impressed if you get the mass
right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a good question. I wonder if that's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it may be that they're putting that into their model to
reduce the number of computer and we can look it up.
Yeah, I'm looking at the abstract, and the state of play in the abstract are very weak compared to what you would say.
Okay, anyway, are there other questions?
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Actually, let me thank everyone in the audience who's presented to us. We've really learned a lot, so we really appreciate your contribution. Thank you very much.